This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Crime is rising around the country and here in Charlotte, particularly homicides. The homicide rate here last year was 13.3% higher than 2015, with 68 homicides reported by CMPD. And so far this year, with just 3 months under our belts, as of last night, there have been 22 homicides. 16 of those victims were black, 3 were white, 3 were Latino. One reason, according to CMPD Chief Kerputney, easy access to guns and a hair-trigger willingness to use them.
The issue with gun violence is a serious issue across the country and here locally. We have too many people that want to settle minor disputes with a firearm. So we're focused on our priority offenders that we see who continue to engage in gun violence. If I'm willing to point a gun at you or shoot into a house that's occupied, I'm much more likely to commit a homicide.
The Centers for Disease Control calls this rising homicide rate a serious public health problem that requires a public health approach, and we're going to examine it from several angles during the next hour. We begin by digging a little deeper into what's going on around the country with Dr. Michael Turner, professor and chair of the Department of Criminal Justice and Criminology at UNC Charlotte. He joins us for this first segment by phone. Thanks for being here, Doctor.
Thanks for inviting me.
You're welcome. Is it true that despite all the rhetoric from politicians, America is actually safer overall today than it was just a few decades ago?
I believe that is true. If you look at the data, and which I'll start out by saying there's things we know, things we think we know, and things we don't know. When you look at the things we know and you look at the data, when you compare data now on homicide rates, in the last 2 years, even though we've had upticks, we are still safer than we've been in pretty much any time in my adult life.
Is it also true that crime and homicide rates have fallen nationwide, but that fall is being obscured, I guess, by the rising crime and homicide rates in major cities, and among those major cities would be our own?
That is true. Not all major cities, though. I think L.A. and New York continue to have relatively low and very small increases in the homicide rates. Chicago is an anomaly in that situation. And they clearly have a problem there and clearly have a much greater increase in their homicide rates than other very large cities. Now, those cities that are a little bit below that, that's where you're seeing some spikes. Baltimore, Dallas, Houston, various other cities, Washington, D.C., that you see that are accounting for a large proportion of this spike in the homicide rate.
Well, in fact, The Guardian reports that a third of last year's 10.8% murder increase in America, the single biggest leap in decades, was driven by violence in just 10 cities. Are we among those cities?
I think we are in terms of, if you're going to look at raw growth, but I think we moved from, 60 to 68 homicides in the last 2 years, from a low in 2014 in the 40s. So we have significant growth, and we are have reason to be concerned. But I would say this, that the aggregate homicide rates that you just described in terms of a small proportion of cities accounting for a large proportion of the increase, that also reflects behavior at the individual level, where we know that a small proportion of offenders account for the majority amount of crime.
I haven't seen that top 10 list, but I have seen in the reading that I did yesterday, some cities continually crop up as being high homicide rate cities, and they include St. Louis and Detroit, Birmingham, Alabama, Memphis, Milwaukee, Rockford, Little Rock, and Oakland and Kansas City. Is there something about those cities? Do those cities have something in common, aside from the murder rate, that would lead to the murder rate being what it is?
Well, based on the data, I would say two things. Based on the data I've seen, first of all, they have high levels of poverty and high levels of ethnic minorities, particularly black and Latino populations. So there's that in place, but there's also the fact that with smaller cities, the base rate is so low, so any rise in raw numbers of homicides look like a relatively significantly increase in the rate of homicide. So when base rates are low, any amount or any increase looks like a relatively large increase. And that's what you're seeing with, I think, some of the smaller cities. But they do have some common characteristics with regards to what I said, the concentrated poverty and things of those sorts. And when you look at the geographic distribution of those, of the homicides in those areas, and you see this most clearly in Chicago, it's not the whole city of Chicago that is experiencing serious or high homicide rates. It's relatively concentrated into a small segments or small geographic areas with that are generally characterized by high levels of poverty, concentrated poverty, and high levels of African-Americans.
But we've had high levels of concentrated poverty in cities throughout America for decades. What has happened in the recent, the last couple of years, the last 2 years? What has happened that suddenly we have this surge of homicides?
Well, I'll leave that to some of my colleagues on with you, but because I think we move to an area where we get to speculating about what we think we know. And, you know, there's various theories out there, the Ferguson effect, where police officers are less willing to get out of their car and work with community members because of the issues that went down in Ferguson, Missouri. There's issues with regards to, or theories with regards to, maybe we're releasing more inmates and those individuals are engaging in more violent behavior at rates unparalleled in the past. But, you know, that's I think we're in a place where we need to understand what the data are telling us and truly identify a trend, and that is the growth in homicide rates before we start actually converging on various theories about what is actually happening or why things are happening.
I want to get back to something you said about Chicago. You characterized Chicago as being an anomaly, and the president has quite often brought up Chicago as an indication that we are a violence-ridden nation and murders happening as you walk down the street left and right. You said that the violence in Chicago is pretty much concentrated in a certain part of Chicago, but since it's an anomaly, but it's such an enormous anomaly, is it simply human a human behavioral characteristic that we look at a place like Chicago and we see those numbers out of Chicago and we assume that it's the same everywhere?
I think that's what the media's impact is on people. You saw this during the election period that, you know, some of the candidates were talking about the rise and this concern in the violent crime rate, et cetera. And I think when you and others and what we hear in the media with regards to crime is on the rise, violence is on the rise, we think it's a problem that exists everywhere. Mm-hmm. And we don't talk about the cities that actually experience no changes in violent crime rates or homicide rates or decreases in violent or homicide rates. So we need to balance out the message that we send to individuals.
Well, the problem here, and we're going to talk about this later in the program, you bring up an interesting point. We would not be doing a show on the on the lack of homicides in city X, Y, or Z. There's simply no news there. So, I mean, that is news, but it's not to the degree of the kind of homicide rate we see in Chicago or the fact in the first 3 months here in Charlotte of this year, we've had 22 homicides. That's news. That's troubling. What would you have us do?
I do think that is troubling, and I do think it is something that we should pay attention to, and I do think we should engage in discussions on why that is happening once we understand that it is truly a trend. And I think of the violent or the homicide rates as, you know, there's a glass floor there, right? They're only going to get so low. And we've just, you know, had 20 years or 20-something years of sustained decreases, but for like 05 and 06, sustained decreases in the homicide rates. And then we have now 2 years of an uptick that seemed to be accounted for by a relatively small proportion of cities. I'm not sure that's a nationwide problem. I think that's more of a local problem within the city. I would even go a little bit further and say I think it's more of a neighborhood problem.
Because you say that you stress that it's important to place recent violence statistics in their proper social context. When you do that, what do you learn?
Well, I learned that our homicide rates, our violence rates, are about what they were in 2007 and 2008. And if you look at the previous 30 years, we've never been safer. That's what I would say.
Wow. Dr. Michael Turner is professor and chair of the Department of Criminal Justice and Criminology at UNC Charlotte. Well, that last statistic, the fact that we've never been safer, is an example of what you'd like to see us do in the media, I take it. So spread that word. Thank you for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Charlotte is taking the rise in crime and homicides very seriously, and one organization leading the effort to understand the cause and find solutions is also the organization on the front lines of dealing with the aftermath of gun violence, Carolinas Medical Center. They are hosting the 12th annual Youth Violence Prevention Conference, which they are titling, Why is Violence in America on the Rise and What Must Charlotte Do? It's an all-day affair at Friendship Missionary Baptist Church on April 7th. Dr. David Jacobs is medical director and trauma surgeon at the F.H. Sammy Ross Jr. Trauma Center and chairman of the Carolinas Medical Center's Violence Prevention Committee. He's in our Spirit Square studio. Welcome.
Good morning.
Along with Daryl Stevens, who's the former chief of CMPD and now the executive director of the Major Cities Chiefs Association. Welcome back to you as well.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Get a little closer to that microphone, if you would. Dr. Jacobs, let me begin with you. CMC and the Charlotte Area Health Education Center sponsoring this 12th annual Youth Violence Prevention Conference. 12 years this has been going on. Has anything substantive come from previous conferences?
Well, I'd like to think so. The purpose of the conference is to really empower and educate the community about violence and to reinforce the notion that violence is a preventable issue. I think a lot of us become fatalistic about this and think that it just has to happen. And the emphasis on all of the conferences that we've had is that the people that come have a role to play, have a responsibility in their communities, where they work, where they worship, to work on violence prevention. And there are things that individuals can do to bring down violence in their communities and in Charlotte. And that's, again, the bottom line of this year's conference.
We experienced our 22nd homicide just last night here in Charlotte. Given the 22 people who have died this year, can you say they were all young people or that the violence was all committed by young people? Why do you concentrate on youth violence and not violence in general?
I think if you look at violence rates across the country and you look at the population that's most likely to be impacted both as perpetrators and as victims, youth violence is the issue. The highest rates of incarceration, homicide, victimization occur in individuals between the ages of 18 and 30. And so we can talk about youth violence. Or we can talk about violence in general, but really youth violence is what drives violence across the country.
One of the thrusts of this conference, as I understand it, is going to be an attempt to answer the question of whether this sudden rise in the number of homicides in Charlotte is merely a blip or the start of a new upward trend. Do you have any theories about what it might be?
I think Dr. Turner touched on that earlier. There's a lot of theories that have been put forward. I don't think we know. I think what I've learned from looking at this is that it does tend to be a local problem. And what the cause of the uptick in Chicago is different than what the uptick is in Baltimore and what the uptick is in Charlotte. And people have to begin to look at their own communities and devise solutions that pertain to their own community. So what's going to work in Chicago may not work here. We have to do some work here locally.
Dr. David Jacobs is with us from Carolinas Medical Center. And Daryl Stevens, not yet a doctor, but he's working on it. former chief of police at CMPD and executive director of Major Cities Chiefs Association is also here. We'll continue in a moment. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members at Cal Atlantic Homes, featuring four villages plus five new floor plans in the community of Braden in the Fort Mill School District. Braden offers a private residence club, pool, and playground. CalAtlanticHomes.com. And historic Rural Hills Loch Norman Highland Games, April 8th and 9th, Scottish competitions, Celtic music, and kids' activities. Details at RuralHill.net. 3 years ago, Charlotte learned something unflattering and uncomfortable about itself. Our state of upward mobility is the lowest among the nation's top 50 cities. The Opportunity Task Force was set up to investigate the reasons and to try to make some suggestions for change. They've just released a report that makes nearly 100 recommendations. There's no silver bullet in all of this, but there is food for thought, and they will share that with us tomorrow on this program at 9.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, the Brexit begins. The UK officially kicks off its divorce from the European Union. We'll look at the road ahead. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
Join On Point this morning from 10 to noon, right after Charlotte talks with Mike Collins on listener-funded public radio, 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the rise in homicide and other violence and crime, particularly in Charlotte. We'll focus now on Charlotte with Daryl Stevens, former chief of police here and executive director of the Major Cities Chiefs Association, and Dr. David Jacobs, who is on the front line of all this, the results of all this, because he's a trauma surgeon at Carolina's Medical Center. We've said already in this program that we are safer in America than we have been in decades. The Washington Post said that recently in an article, despite the increase in homicides. So are most of these homicides occurring, Daryl Stevens, in mostly impoverished neighborhoods?
That's true. And that's been true for almost 50 years that I've been involved in policing. Violence, homicide rates, homicides are concentrated in your high poverty areas of cities. Some are have much more of those areas, and so you find a greater number of homicides and greater levels of violence take place. But it's been the case for many years.
Of course, police work concentrates on prevention and apprehension of those who do commit crimes. But do you get into the reasons behind the crimes? I mean, obviously you understand at some point during an investigation what happened. So are people in policing helping to contribute to the database that help us to understand why this is happening?
They absolutely are. And it's been a practice in many cities over the years to engage in problem solving. Charlotte has been on the forefront of that for a long time. And if you engage in problem solving, then you begin to ask the question, why are this crime or homicides that we're talking about now, why are they taking place in our communities? What's contributing to the environment where one turns to violence to resolve conflict? And so there's been a lot of work by police departments, by researchers that have explored that topic pretty thoroughly.
Of course, a lot of this is the availability of guns, one would think, and you're a trauma surgeon, and you've been there when people are brought in and who are the victims of gun violence, and other surgeons on other programs have talked about what it looks like in some of these hospital ERs, like a war zone, and that people are coming in with injuries that you used to associate with battlefield injuries. Is that the case here?
Oh, absolutely. We've gotten to the point now where the military are now sending their surgeons and their medical personnel to some of our larger urban trauma centers so that they can get trained, because they're not necessarily getting the training that they need in the military, but they can get it at some of our major urban trauma centers.
So it's worse. If you're training military doctors, it's you have more experience.
Well, I think it depends upon how you look at it. But certainly, there are many cities across the country that can provide the kinds of training that need to be provided for the military, certainly.
Wow. Percentages, Daryl Stevens, can be deceiving. For instance, when you see that a city like Boston witnessed a homicide rate increase in the last 2 years of 69%, you as a tourist might be afraid to walk the Freedom Trail. But then you discover that figure, 69%, represents fewer than 50 people. In Orlando, the homicide rate was up 712% in a year, just over 50 people, and I don't think that includes the people who died in that nightclub.
It does.
It does.
It does include them.
Which would make that a real anomaly. While Chicago saw over 300 people killed, their murder rate rose by only 50%. So using that comparison, how bad is the situation in Charlotte?
Well, if you you look at Charlotte, during the highest rate homicide rates that we had in Charlotte were in the early 90s. It reached 28.7 per 100,000 people. In 2016, last year, the rate was 7.9. so 300% lower than what it was in the early 90s. Of course, we've had population increases and that type of thing, which affects the rates. But the actual numbers are different, too. I believe we said 68 were killed. In the early 90s, it was not unusual to have 120, 125 people killed by homicides in the city of Charlotte. And the population was before consolidation, mm-hmm. so the population was around 350,000 at that time.
That's enormous.
Yes, it's a very, very high rate. If Charlotte's rate were that way today, they would be among the top one or two, and it's just not the case.
So should we be looking at percentages, or should we be looking at raw numbers and the increase or the decline in the raw number from year to year?
I think you should be looking at both. Rates are important. The percentage changes are important, but you have to understand the context. You mentioned Orlando. That big jump, they've had an increase in homicides separate from the pulse, but that big, big number was the pulse victims that caused that to change so much.
Mm-hmm. As I mentioned at the beginning of the program, we have had 22 homicides here so far this year. 16 of the victims were black, 3 were white, 3 were Latino. Were their killers the same race?
The demographic of the killers, the suspects, look pretty much the same as the victims. And that's been an issue in Charlotte and urban America for many years. Back in 2005 or 2006, we had a jump in homicides and violent crime in those years. We had a task force that was created by the city council, and we looked at Charlotte's homicides very, very carefully for almost a year, and it was a problem that's concentrated in our neighborhood, in our high-poverty neighborhoods, African-American victims, African-American suspects. We had a lot of recommendations. Unfortunately, they were not followed through on outside of what the recommendations the police could do.
It's wrong to leap to a conclusion like this, but let me get your professional perspective. If the people involved in shooting the victims were the same race or the same ethnic origin, is it safe to say that most of these were not random acts of violence, that the perpetrator knew the victim or associated at some point with the victim?
That's safe to say. There's historically, the large majority, the violence takes place between people who are relatives, husband, wife, or their acquaintances. They know each other. Not all, but a substantial proportion of them does.
Dr. David Jacobs is with us in our studio from Carolina's Medical Center. Daryl Stevens here from the Major Cities Chiefs Association. And with us now by phone is Dr. Alex Crosby, branch chief of the surveillance branch in the Division of Violence Prevention at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Crosby.
Hello.
Given that the homicide rate is rising in America, could the same be true of most of the killings in America, that the victims knew their assailants?
Most of the research that's been done from the public health perspective, and I think also what we heard from Mr. Stevens, shows that the majority of homicide victims knew the person who was the suspect or the perpetrator. As was already mentioned, you know, sometimes family member, friend, relative, something along those lines. So that also kind of leads us to thinking about the interventions when many of the people that die of homicide know the person who was the suspect or the perpetrator.
So that should give some people out there some comfort to think that these homicides are not random acts of violence in most cases. You're not going to be gunned down on the street just because you're walking on the street in most cases. But then on the other hand, it's very troubling to know that the assailant knows the victim and vice versa, because that says something about interpersonal relationships. What does that tell us?
Well, that does tell us that, you know, part of our strategy in trying to address violence and especially interpersonal violence has to do with, you know, some of the human behavior that's involved with that and to understand, you know, how we can make people better able to, you know, to cope with difficulties and stressors in their lives. And so there are various ways in which we try to deal with those kind of issues in some of the prevention activities, along with thinking about the environment and the circumstances in which people live, that you can improve those too and also make violence less likely to occur.
I said in the beginning that the Centers for Disease Control calls the rising homicide rate a serious public health problem that requires a public health approach. That may surprise some people. Why do you feel that way, and what would a public health approach to this problem look like?
It does surprise some people. I think that when we talk about a public health approach, one of the things to make clear to those who are listening is that we're not talking about just public health addressing the issue, so not just the health department. But when we address violence from a public health approach, generally we're talking about, you know, what are the strengths, the capabilities of public health, what are the kind of tools that public health has, and allowing public health to work with partners, and that's a key piece. And I think in almost all areas of public health, we work with partners. We work with, you know, schools. We work with criminal justice. We work with law enforcement. We work with social services. We work with various organizations, public and private, around the cities, around the counties, around the country, to try to address the issue. One of the also perspectives in terms of public health is that we really try to emphasize prevention and trying to see where we can stop the problem before it even starts. That doesn't mean that you don't address victims, you know, whether that's, you know, the fatalities, but also, you know, in families, but then also the non-fatal. But really, we want to emphasize on trying to prevent the problem before it even starts.
Dr. Jacobs, you are the chair of the Violence Prevention Committee at Carolina's Medical Center. Is that how CMC approaches this as a public health problem?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think if you stood back and looked at a disease, if you will, that kills somewhere between 15 and 20 million people a year, mm-hmm. And you know that it has a predilection for young men of color, you know some of the risk factors in terms of some of the socioeconomic things that we've identified, and you know that there are that there's research-proven interventions that work, then it makes all the sense in the world to think about this as a disease and use the public health approach. From a purely cost standpoint, it makes a lot of sense to prevent the next person who's going to get shot, prevent the next person who's going to get killed, just because from a cost perspective, it's much – you save a lot of money from not having to provide medical care for that patient. So the Violence Prevention Committee is looking at the issue from the individual perspective, from the community perspective, but also from the perspective of a healthcare system that has to take care of a population of patients, and what's the best way to take care of a disease? That's to prevent it in the first place.
Well, let me talk to you, Dr. Jacobs, and to you, Dr. Crosby, about how you do that, because a lot of this, and I'm curious to know how much of this violence and this gun violence or homicide rate is due to the seething frustration and anger that is out there among parts of the community that permeates a lot of poverty-stricken communities, and particularly young men, young African-American men, who feel that they have been targeted unfairly by police and by society at large. How do you prevent that? Because that seething anger is there. I'll start with you, Dr. Jacobs.
Well, this is obviously a very complicated problem that cuts across socioeconomics, cuts across race, cuts across gender. But I think that we know that violence in general comes as a result of risk factors and protective factors. And everybody's got risk factors, but everybody has a variable level of protective factors. And so there are things that we can do as individuals, as communities, as teachers, as healthcare workers to bolster or to strengthen the resilience of the folks who are struggling with issues of socioeconomic inequality, can't find a job, substance abuse, those kinds of things. And so in this day and age, when these are the kinds of programs that are facing cuts, I think we have to recognize that we may end up paying the price for that sooner or later. So enriching the access of our kids to those kinds of enrichment programs, which will bolster their ability to counter their risk factors.
Dr. Crosby, same question about how you deal with prevention and the seething anger and frustration that's out there. And are there examples that you know of around the country where prevention programs have been particularly successful?
Oh, yes, there definitely have been places. There are certain cities that have been very successful in implementing programs. And one of the things that is a common theme when you look at some of the cities that have done these programs is they are comprehensive. And I think just as Dr. Jacobs was alluding to, you deal with not only the individual circumstances of particular people, but then also kind of their community and societal environment. And so one of the things that CDC has done is we recently released what we call a technical package on youth violence prevention. And what that technical package is it talks about strategies that have shown that they work, scientifically evaluated programs that have shown that they work in regards to reducing youth violence, and talks about the underlying strategy. You know, what does that mean? How did that strategy work? What is it based on? Those risk and protective factors. How does it try to lower the risk or enhance the protection? And so one of the things, just as, you know, one of the strategies that's mentioned there talks about economic supports. And I think just as Dr. Jacobs was talking about, how do you keep children in school, adolescents, young children in school, because that increases their opportunities. How do you improve job opportunities in certain communities? So those kind of things, strengthening those economic supports, are one of the strategies that, as you might imagine, not many people might think, you know, economic strategies? How does that have to do with violence? But when we've really looked at the science that underlies that, they work, and they actually show that it works across a number of different issues. Violence is one of them.
In cities where this strategy is being employed, by whom is it being employed? Who's rolling this out? Who's running it, administering these programs?
Those usually are a joint effort. And so, for example, in Minneapolis, the mayor led the program, but he brought together the law enforcement community, brought together public health, brought together the clinical community in terms of medical care, brought together social services, brought together a number of different organizations, as well as private businesses. So in those cities that have really been successful, it is usually that kind of coalition, if you will, of multiple agencies that bring them together, and depends on, you know, who might be kind of leading that group, or maybe probably facilitating is probably a better word than leading it. You know, in Minneapolis, definitely the mayor was playing a big role in that. But in other cities, sometimes it's the health department that's leading the effort. But, you know, you're bringing all of those groups and all of their skills and tools together and having them put all of those things in action in a coordinated way.
I may come back in a moment and get Charlotte's, the answer to the question with regard to Charlotte, who's administering this kind of stuff in Charlotte, because you've been doing the violence prevention seminars. This will be the 12th coming up in April, Dr. Jacobs. We'll do that when we come back from the break. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members in Carolina Pest Management, protecting homes and families since 1939, offering environmentally responsible Centricon termite colony elimination system, plus other green pest, mosquito, and moisture control services. CarolinaPest.com. The Brexit has begun. 9 months after UK voters approved a split from the European Union, Prime Minister Theresa May, just late last night, our time, in the morning their time, triggered the divorce process with a letter to the EU and told British lawmakers there is no turning back. A look at the road ahead coming up with Tom Ashbrook on Point in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can do so through email, charlottetalks@wfae.org, search for WFAE on Facebook, or get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks. We're coming right back.
Every day that news breaks,
the president's been forced to fire his national security advisor.
More water is coming over the emergency spillway.
Two loud groups that are here that are gathered outside.
I heard someone yell, "Get out of my country."
Then there was gunfire.
Locally, there have been 60 to 70 unauthorized immigrants picked
up here. NPR News is there with context and clarity through the first 100 days of a new administration and beyond. Listen every day.
Keep up with your NPR News source, 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the rising homicide rate in Charlotte and elsewhere around the country in the last several years, after years of a declining rate, which still is pretty much declining, but there are pockets of increases, and we are among them, with Dr. David Jacobs, who's a medical director and trauma surgeon at the Sammy Ross Trauma Center at Carolina's Medical Center and the chair of the Violence Prevention Committee there. Daryl Stevens is a former chief of CMPD and executive director of the Major Cities Chiefs Association, and Dr. Alex Crosby is branch chief of the surveillance branch in the Division of Violence Prevention at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta. In Charlotte, are there programs like Dr. Crosby was talking about, Dr. Jacobs, to help prevent violence? And if so, who's administering them? How successful have they been?
I think there are a number of programs. I think where Charlotte struggles is trying to coordinate those programs. So there's a number of agencies, part of whose mission is violence prevention, but we don't have an agency whose sole focus is on that. And so I think, as has been mentioned, there is a role to play here by healthcare, by law enforcement, by the school system. Mm-hmm. And so I think what we need more is a coordinated effort to try to bring all those agencies together, because I think one of the things that Dr. Crosby mentioned is the same risk factors that we are talking about in terms of violence are also involved in a number of activities that concern youth development. So whether it's teenage pregnancy, whether it's substance abuse, whatever it may be, the risk factors tend to be the same. And so I think if we can get everybody on the same page, pulling in the same direction, we'll have more impact.
Well, the American Chiefs Association, Daryl Stevens, says that police chiefs around the country point to several factors in this rise in crime and homicide: the existence of gangs, the opioid epidemic, social media, repeat offenders, guns, and federal gun prosecution. Can you rank those in order of importance?
Well, yes, this would just be my own ranking. I think the gun issue is an enormous issue for America and for America's urban centers.
Are most homicides in America committed with a gun?
Two-thirds of them.
And the other weapons would be what?
Mostly knives and blunt instruments and that kind of thing. But guns is overwhelming, the overwhelming cause of homicides, and the carnage that Dr. Jacobs repairs. People treats them that survive. Mm-hmm. And our policies in America, many states, have become have changed so much that people can basically strap on a gun, carry it anywhere.
You bring up an interesting point. We're talking about the homicide rate. There were 22 in Charlotte so far this year. How many people did not die? How many people were shot in Charlotte, came to your trauma unit, or the one at Presbyterian or Novant, and survived, that we don't really count in these statistics?
Well, you're absolutely right. The homicide rate is just the tip of the iceberg, and I can't give you the exact number. But, you know, when we look at the 20-year trend of decreasing homicides across the country, one of the theories that was put forward was because we've gotten so much better as trauma centers that we're saving people that formerly were not able to be saved. But clearly, homicide is a very easy thing to measure. Either you're dead or you're not
dead.
So
the number of people that you have saved has increased because the number of people that you are seeing has increased?
Well, there's no question that the more people that you see, the better you get at what you do. And so, yes, in general, survival from major trauma has improved over the last 20 years, but I would not go as far as to say that that's the reason that homicide rates have decreased.
When we talk about this as a public health crisis, Dr. Crosby, should we be including those numbers of people who were shot and survived?
I think we should. If we are trying to measure the burden or the scope of violence, you wouldn't just talk about those that have died. And it's very similar as if you're thinking about any kind of disease, whether that's diabetes or high blood pressure or an infectious disease like Ebola or like Zika, if you only count the number of people that die as a result of diabetes, you'd only get, as Dr. Jacobs just mentioned, you just get the tip of the iceberg. It is really much bigger when you talk about the non-fatal or the morbidity that's caused by that particular disease. And so it is important for us to look at the broader range of how violence impacts communities, and not just the victims that survive, as an example of a gunshot wound, but then also the families and the communities. How are they impacted by, you know, a loved one or a friend have to be hospitalized, may have some permanent damage, whether that's physical damage, whether that's psychological damage. All of those things play a role and impact our society. So it's important for us to examine the broad scope of what violence causes in communities.
Right. And, you know, and I think that an old professor told me that the only difference between the violence victim that gets shot and seen in the ED and sent home and the one that doesn't get to the hospital is aim. If you've got good aim, then the bullet goes to the head or the bullet goes to the chest and the patient dies. But the underlying causes, the demographics, the causes that cause that person to be shot are exactly the same as the person who dies. And so we should treat them exactly the same.
So let's go back to what the American Chiefs Association says is contributing to this, the factors that are contributing. And one of the things that you mentioned, Daryl Stevens, was the social media has contributed to this. In what way? How has that happened?
It's a form of communication that allows you to reach large numbers of people that you used to have a face-to-face contact with. And we've seen in a number of our big cities young people, gangs, taunting other people, challenging them. And the response is to go get your gun and go after them and settle the score.
Because of a tweet or a Facebook post.
Because of a tweet or a Facebook post. Mm. And that's mentioned in Chicago. It's mentioned in Philadelphia. A number of other cities talk about the number of homicides that they've had because of that. Mm.
You also say the federal government has declined to prosecute some defendants on gun possession charges. Why?
That's been going down for quite a number of years. It's partly federal judges don't believe that those cases should be in federal court, and so they discourage prosecutors from bringing those cases to court. The new attorney general is going to emphasize that, and so we hope to see them come up. The problem that police chiefs talk about is young people who are people on the street who are not legally entitled to carry or possess a gun.
Right.
Convicted felons, for one. And so the prosecution at the state level, the sentences are such that there's basically no accountability for breaking those laws. And they come to the conclusion that they'd rather be caught with a gun than without one.
Following the rash of shootings that we saw on television last summer and prior to that of African-American males by police across the country, there were riots in some cities, including our own. There were incidents of police being charged and mm-hmm. tried for shootings, incidents of police being targeted by citizens because of what they perceive to be unfair treatment of police of their own people. Some people believe that this has helped lead to an increase in homicides because police officers have become disengaged. They're not going to get out of the car. They're not going to go into that neighborhood because they don't want to be targeted and they don't want to have an incident happen that puts them into a difficult situation. How big a factor has that been in the rise?
That's a really hard one to gauge, Mike. A Pew poll that was released just a couple of months ago indicated that police officers, a sample of over 8,000, indicated that they're more reluctant to engage people. In fact, 85% of them. 90% says their job is a lot harder. But from my perspective of being involved in policing for years and from the data that we've seen from police departments where the Ferguson effect gets talked about, they say that their stops and gun recoveries and that kind of thing have not changed all of that much. I don't think police officers are wired in a way that would cause them not to do the job that they signed up to do. And I think most of them are doing that.
It isn't just the homicide rate that's increased. Crime rates in general have increased in Charlotte. Nearly 9% rise in robberies over 2015, last year over 2015. 11% increase in aggravated assaults, 25% increase in vehicle theft. In fact, our overall crime rate in Charlotte last year was 17% above the city's five-year average. Is all of this connected in some way?
It is to some extent. Now, I would have to look at that auto theft because we've seen declines of over a number of years, largely due to technology. But we've in a lot of cities. It's not all. It's mostly the urban environments where we've seen these kinds of increases, and there are connections. I think that a lot of the property crime gets connected to our substance abuse problems, the opioid crisis, and the other substances that we've seen huge jumps in overdoses and.
But the opioid crisis, the opioid problem, permeates the city at large. It's not concentrated necessarily in impoverished neighborhoods. It happens in Ballantyne. It's happening in Myers Park. Because it originates with pain prescription drugs and then goes to heroin because
there's
you get cut off.
No question about that.
So why aren't murders happening everywhere to get these drugs?
Well, that's back to the economic factors. That's back to where people acquire their drugs. Now, 90% of the people who overdose are white. But a lot of those people are able to feed their needs through their own resources. They're not engaged in crime to be able to do that. In our high poverty areas, in our inner cities, it's a different environment. There's conflicts over who's going to handle the trade. If you're a white suburban middle class, upper class person, you can get your drugs safely from your prescriptions and that kind of thing. If you're on the street, you're in dealing with those kind of conflicts. That's why I believe that you see the differences.
Dr. Crosby, there are cities where homicide rates have continued to decline even as they have risen elsewhere, including New York and Los Angeles, which I believe you have already mentioned. What are you finding that's different about those cities?
There are some differences in regards to those cities, you know, and sometimes you're talking about the social environment in those cities, and in other cities, for instance, New Orleans is another one in which they have implemented a comprehensive youth violence program. So I think there's a combination of different things, and I think as we talk about the issue of violence, not to paint it as just being one cause. And I think you've heard from, you know, several of the panel members this morning that there are multiple influences on it. And so, you know, for one city that they're seeing a change, it's oftentimes many different kinds of factors that play a role in those cities. In some cases, it's the violence prevention things that are happening. In some cases, the economy in those cities is making some changes. And in other places, it has to do with, you know, some of the opportunities that are being presented to the population. So there are oftentimes multiple factors that are playing a role.
Economics certainly plays a role. The seething anger and frustration plays a role. How much of this how much of this conflict comes from gang activity or simply the desire for respect and the demand that I not be disrespected or else?
I can tell you a lot of the patients that I see, at least my perception is it's not a huge gang impact. It is the respect factor. So these are minor disagreements that in the context of having a weapon available to you turn deadly. I don't want to get on a soapbox here about the role of the firearm, but clearly if we had the same level of discord, the same cause for the disagreement, but there was no gun present, obviously the lethality would be a whole lot lower.
You know, the crime statistics are quite often used in political rhetoric to drum up support, red meat for the base or whatever, and that there is some fear that these rising rates will be used and have been used and, in fact, have been used by the president with regard to Chicago to whip up some hysteria over crime. But what about why don't people turn to these statistics to whip up support for the root causes? What might be the contributing factors, like the lack of upward mobility, racism, the prison industrial complex, the need for better education, meaningful jobs, affordable housing, etc.? Why don't we see these statistics being used to drum up support for those things or justification for those things?
Well, you know, excuse me. We're going to address many, if not all, of those issues at the conference. But to be quite honest with you, it doesn't jazz up your base. It's not sexy. It's not hot to talk about prevention. It's much easier to talk about things that.
But wouldn't it be better to live in a society where the murder rate was lower, the crime rate was lower in general, and you are the person responsible for that because you saw these as problems and you campaigned on these problems and solved them? Wouldn't that give you a statue in the middle of the park?
It would, but it doesn't affect the majority of Americans. And so if you're not feeling you're directly affected by it, then I'm not going to contribute to help and resolve it, which is why we have such a difficult time resolving it.
And do you think that most people believe, and it's true, most people believe that crime is rampant in America? Do they believe that because they're being told by politicians or because they're being told by the media and they're seeing a steady diet of blue flashing lights on the local news? Shows the fact that we're talking about it right now? Does that lead to all of this?
Part of it is the media, but I think part of it, when they say crime, they're thinking about their credit card that was stolen. They're thinking about their ID theft, and so that's, I think, contributes to that belief.
Daryl Stevens is a former chief of CMPD and the executive director of the Major Cities Chiefs Association. Dr. Alex Crosby is with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta. He joined us by phone. Dr. David Jacobs, medical director and trauma surgeon at the Sammy Ross Trauma Center at Carolina's Medical Center and the chair of the Violence Prevention Committee there. Thank you all for the hour.